the Deco Retro program here on Planet FM. We will bring you interesting interviews, updates of future deco, modern, retro, and other related events. Also, the stories that celebrate New Zealand's history and its people, as well as book reviews and other snippets capturing the glamour and fascination of a bygone era.
Deco Retro, Deco Retro, Deco Retro.
Good afternoon, listeners, and welcome to the Deco Retro program. Presently, the recording studios at Planet FM are not available to us, as Planet FM is still in the process of moving to their new premises in New North Road. So instead, I will endeavour to record this month's Deco Retro program from home. Today, our program is about the St. James Theatre in Auckland, now unfortunately mothballed and no longer in use. Recently I came across my programme for the New Zealand Ballet's Royal Gala performance of Coppelia at the St. James Theatre, Auckland, on the 18th of April 1983, in the presence of Prince Charles and his beautiful wife, Princess Diana. It was certainly a night to remember. The gloriously ornate interior of the St. James provided the perfect backdrop for such an unforgettable event. The St. James Theatre in Auckland and the St. James in Wellington were both designed by the architect Henry Eli White, Australasia's most famous and prolific theatre designer, with more than 130 theatres to his credit. The St. James in Lawn Street in Auckland's CBD is a heritage stage theatre and cinema built in 1928 to replace the older Fuller's Opera House. It was originally designed for vaudeville acts. It opened in 1928 but was closed in 2007 because of safety and compliance concerns following a fire inside the theatre. British author Duncan Fallowell, who wrote the travel book Going As Far As I Can, made it his mission to visit the St. James Theatre in Auckland, where Sir Laurence Olivier and his then wife, Vivian Lee, had once performed, only to find, after arriving in Auckland, that nobody seemed to know where it was. He did eventually locate the St. James, finding it shut up, dingy and dead. However, he was fortunate enough to be allowed inside, where, to his amazement, he was blown away by the interior, and this is how he described it. A sort of neo-Byzantine basilica, capped by a massively coffered ceiling. Ranged about this colossal hall were freestanding lanterns done in the baronial style, each as tall as a person. A broad staircase with barley sugar banisters curved up from the main foyer, its back wall embossed with Corybantic Greeks. Above the bottom of the staircase, there hung a tasseled flag stitched with Mezzanine Lounge in gold letters. Inside the theatre, when they switched on the stained glass lamps, the auditorium glimmered cavernously into life. Ornate opera boxes bulged either side of the stage. The decor, more ambiguous than before. Florentine medieval, Venetian Renaissance, jeweled and bloodthirsty Jacobean in pantomime mode. To Duncan, after the shoddy takeaways of Queen Street, such an enormity was difficult to comprehend. What on earth was all this doing here? And how could such a vast declaration have been turned into such a secret? His guide said, "We hold raves here," as he looked on the stage on which Vivian Leigh and Laurence Olivier played. She told Duncan that she used to live in Rodine, the house in Parnell that Larry and Viv had rented, now demolished, of course. As they entered upon the stately rise of marble steps, cornices of bronze filigree threw an apricot glow from concealed lamps up into the vault. It was more like an opium dream than a building. "Are the opera boxes used?" "They used to be, for shows, but there hasn't been live theatre here for years. When Queen Elizabeth and the Duke of Edinburgh came, a long time ago, they sat them in one of the opera boxes and made special chairs for them. I've got one. I found it, moth-eaten out the back, and had it recovered. Don't know what happened to the other one." She flicked more switches, revealing pillars with rich capitals of grotesque ornament, black Ganymedes in stone niches holding torches aloft and lit lavender from behind. The entire mezzanine lounge throbbed in a deep orange and red light. It was pagan, infernal. The hellish hue poured through the cornices and melted upwards, making a fiery furnace over our heads. Here was a space fit for Cleopatra's suicide. Duncan didn't speak for quite a while. It had been a long time since he had been so affected by a decayed, forgotten palace. In this case, a palace of entertainment. "Why doesn't the local council do something?" "They're not interested. They were offered it for a dollar, but turned it down and built that new thing opposite." "But it must be the most lavish piece of neglect in the city." She shrugs. "When the theatre first opened, there were terrible protests about those naked boys in the alcoves, so they had to put fig leaves on them. But my favourite theatre was His Majesty's. They bulldozed it. There were demonstrations. People handcuffed themselves to the doors, that sort of thing. It was an absolute gem. Not big like this, but so pretty. And a lovely old arcade of shops was attached to it. But the bulldozers went in overnight and flattened it." "Did the arcade go too?" "Of course. Then the developer, a young man, went bust. And so nothing was built there. For years it was a car park. For years. Ah, so much has been destroyed." While he was in Auckland, Duncan Fallowell visited Shirley O'Connor, whose husband used to put on shows in the theatre. Dan O'Connor was the impresario who set up the old Vic Theatre Company tour of 1948. The cast was headed by the famous theatrical couple, Laurence Olivier and his wife, Vivian Leigh. Mrs. O'Connor told Duncan that before the war, Dan brought the Vienna Boys' Choir out to Australia. At the outbreak of war, the boys were in Melbourne. He wrote to their parents to ask if they would like them to be sent home or remain where they were, and every single parent requested that their boy should remain. She showed Duncan the souvenir program of the 1948 Old Vic Theatre tour. When asked about the St. James, this is what Shirley had to say. After the war, Dan thought he would like to bring over the Ballet Rambert and the Old Vic Company. The St. James Theatre was owned by Kerridge Odeon, and Bob Kerridge suggested Dan use it. Though it was built as a theatre, for many years it had been used only as a cinema. However, it had an orchestra pit, which was needed for the ballet. All the musicians for the ballet had to come out from England. We had our National Symphony Orchestra, but it was run like a trades union. They would look at their watches and stop in the middle of a movement, unless they were paid money. Actually, they were part of the plumbers' union, and there was a reason for that, but I've forgotten what it was. The NSO couldn't sight-read well enough to play for the ballet, but in order to enforce union rights, they sat themselves underneath the stage while the English musicians performed in the pit. Shirley also told him that during the Old Vic tour, Olivia developed a painful knee problem and had his leg operated on in Wellington. He was in agony a lot of the time, but manfully waited until the end of the tour for the operation. Afterwards, his leg was sticking out in plaster, so he was winched aboard the ship, bound for England by a crane. The photo went all over the world. Then the Old Vic had a month on the boat back to England. Shirley told Duncan that in those days, if travelling by air, you'd fly London to Cairo, Cairo to Singapore, Singapore to Christmas Island, Christmas Island to Auckland. The old Constellation had a lounge bar in its tail. You could wander down, have a drink, and talk to the other passengers. We had flying boats, too, of course, between Sydney and Auckland. While she was driving him back to his hotel, Duncan asked Shirley, how did she find the Olivias? Charming, charming, but they were putting on a good front. He had a great sense of humour. Although I say that, when many years later Dan and I visited Larry down in Brighton, it was just after he had been made Lord Olivia, Dan said, how does it feel being the Brighton peer? And Larry didn't get it. The St. James Theatre in Auckland, closed since 2007 after a fire, is now a restoration project with an Auckland Council contribution. Let's take a minute now and hear Anthony Quayle recite Shakespeare's sonnet number 18, Shall I compare thee to a summer's day?
Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a date. Sometime too hot the eye of heaven shines, and often is his gold complexion dimmed, and every fair from fair sometime declines, by chance or nature's changing course untrimmed. But thy eternal summer shall not fade, nor lose possession of that fair thou owest. Nor shall death brag thou wanderest in his shade, when in eternal lines to time thou growest. So long as men can breathe or eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee.
I think it is worth mentioning that the St. James Theatre in Wellington is thought by some to be haunted. In the 1970s, the St. James faded into cinematic obscurity. slowly but surely slumping into dowager decline, the exterior forlornly aging. The movies were not what they were, television eating into audience numbers, the better movies going to newer, smaller theatres, the St. James featuring the more marginal and violent variety. Whole circles were closed off because no film could pull in 2,000 punters. The empty upper levels became the haunt of performers past, as the projectionists and ushers who walked their shadowy rows discovered. The St. James was haunted by the bad times of better days, by the restless spirits of live actors who had died the death on those boards. Apparently, there have been sightings of a male figure wearing a black opera cloak arched across the stomach, thought to be the ghost of Yuri, the Russian ballet dancer pushed to his death half a century ago from the flies, 15 or so meters above the stage, by a woman called Pasha. Then, there is also the wailing woman, said to be a local lady who had acted there, returned in the 1940s to make a comeback, was booed off the stage and killed herself in one of the little dressing rooms off the mezzanine. Jim Hutchinson was 9 years a projectionist at the St. James and believes Yuri saved him on a number of occasions in the 1960s. "I was dressing the stage late one night," he says, "about midnight. I was up on the fly floor and about to head back down when the lights went out. I knew the area pretty well and thought I was by the safety rail, beside the ladder. I felt this very strong feeling of being pushed backwards and this intense cold, like I had a packet of frozen peas on my chest. I looked closely where I was about to step. There was a drop of 10 meters. I was several meters from where I thought I was." Another time he heard a boys' choir in the empty stage area. He went looking for the radio. There was none. He thought it strange, then forgot about it, until he heard of the boys' choir that had played the St. James just before the outbreak of the Second World War. Jim Hutchinson was also puzzled by the experience of his sister-in-law, who was usherette there and heard an uneven tread and heavy wheezing behind her. She turned in the darkened aisle. Nobody there. Hutchinson had to wonder if it was the old manager, Stan Andrews, who came out of his office to check on the ushers, and you could hear him coming by his limp and asthmatic wheezing. He died in 1965. What Jim Hutchinson does know is that he never encountered the paranormal in other cinemas or theatres where he had worked in the past, only at the St. James in Wellington. Jackie Chandler Mills was manager there just before the cinema was sold to Chase Corporation. She recalls seats slammed and lights going on and off if certain music was played, like the Tijuana Brass playing A Taste of Honey. The interesting thing about all these ghostly stories is how benign the ghosts proved upon meeting. The site on which the St. James stands was a churchyard last century. Perhaps this could account for the strange experiences people have reported when working there. I'm reminded of that quote from Shakespeare. "There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy." Let's finish now with The Phantom of the Opera. And if time, we'll follow this with Ave Maria. If you enjoyed our program today, listen every second Wednesday of the month at 2:10 p.m. or download us anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/DecoRetro. And we would like to thank our sponsors, Club Moderne, Art Deco Society Auckland. We will keep you informed of all future exciting and glamorous events to be held by Club Moderne. For more information, email judith.moore650@gmail.com. That's judith.moore650@gmail.com. Bye for now.